Good afternoon and welcome to Week, the news commentary program from the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Zipperer, Vice President of Media and Editorial at the Commonwealth Club and your host for Week to Week. We also welcome our listeners on the internet and invite everyone to visit us at commonwealthclub.org. I'm pleased to introduce our two panelists for today. To my immediate right, Deborah J. Saunders is a syndicated columnist based at the San Francisco Chronicle, where she also writes the blog for sfgate.com called Token Conservative. She's a frequent guest on national radio and television programs. You can follow her on Twitter at Deborah J. Saunders. And to her right, geographically, not politically, is a professor of political science at San Jose State University, Dr. Larry Gersten. You've also seen him as a regular political analyst on NBC 11. He's the author of the new book, Not So Golden After All, The Rise and Fall of California. Later in our program, we will be bringing on stage Brian Caulfield, technology reporter for Forbes magazine and Forbes.com, for an in-depth discussion about iPads and the booming tablet computing market. So let's get started with our discussion of the week in news. Let's start, of course, with the Republican primaries. They're grinding on. Tuesday, we had voting in Alabama, Mississippi, Hawaii, and the big prize, American Samoa. Romney continued to earn delegates, but Santorum seemed to surprise some folks. He surprised some folks. Of course, he's showing staying power. So, Deborah, what's your take on what happened on Tuesday?
Well, the good news is that Newt Gingrich didn't win any states, and I want to concentrate on the good news right now. I've decided to not pay attention for a week or two because it's just too painful.
You're a political reporter.
Yeah, well, there's other news. I think what we're seeing is Mitt Romney walking into the nomination, slowly fighting delegate by delegate, and not convincing Republicans that he's the best person, but nobody really comes up and challenges him. Rick Santorum, I see Rick Santorum going the way that all the other quick shots have gone. It's just taking him longer because there's no one else left. So,
Larry?
I think he's more like backing into the nomination than walking into it. It's hard to believe that Romney will not ultimately gain the nomination. It's possible. It is possible that there'll be an open convention, a brokered convention, however you want to call it. Unlikely, but possible. It's the kind of thing where it demonstrates to me just how unpopular all of these people are with the Republicans, not only conservative Republicans, but even, let's call them mainstream Republicans. None of them really warms anybody. It's too bad because there are an awful lot of good ones out there, you know, the Mitch Daniels, the Rob Portmans, maybe even Chris Christie, not my favorite, Jeb Bush, who I think is a lock in 2016. But you know, for all the various reasons, most of which I think were Obama's incumbency, they chose not to get in. So I think the Republicans are starting from a very, very disadvantaged position for this upcoming election, especially as the economy improves.
It's interesting you mentioned the incumbency kind of scaring off some candidates. The take I remember reading in 1992 was that we didn't have the top tier of Democratic challengers because when the whole process was starting for that primary or the deliberations on that, George Herbert Walker Bush was riding high with whatever astronomical Gulf War opinion polls. So we basically got the B team, and I don't mean it as an insult to them, because of course one of them went on to win. So Barack Obama is not riding high in the polls. I mean, he's fluctuating here and there, and we'll get into gas prices and what that's doing to him now. Could an outsider, could an outlier still get in? I mean, even from the B team.
Very unlikely. Very unlikely, simply because this isn't the kind of thing where you kind of parachute in, you know, and say, okay, I'm here, vote for me. I mean, you have to go ahead and register with all these states and sometimes particular congressional districts. Mm-hmm. You need boots on the ground. You need a lot of money to get organized. And the fact of the matter is that all of that is mostly done. There are very few places that anybody can really get into anymore. Yeah, there's some candidates that could run as a favorite son to muck it up a little bit, or a favorite daughter. But it's a nice picture, but it doesn't work that way. And one other little footnote about 92, and that is I would suggest that Bill Clinton, the comeback kid, whatever he was called, owes a lot to a fellow we've already forgotten.
Ross Perot,
19% of the vote. Okay, and that really made it easy for Clinton.
Yeah. Deborah?
I agree. There's a part of me that would love to see a brokered convention just because I'm a journalist, and also because I'm a Republican and I don't find... You know, the problem with Mitt Romney is I think a lot of Republicans feel about him the way they felt about Meg Whitman before, although she did win the nomination pretty handily when she ran for governor. But I think he's just not resonating with voters. It's not just that Republicans don't think that he's sufficiently conservative. I think they resent some guy who sort of came into this thing thinking, I'm inevitable because I'm spending the most money and I'm going to take the nomination. I think that doesn't work with people. And so Republicans have been looking, and they've been looking for someone who's more genuine. It's interesting how Romney gets all these endorsements from governors, and it doesn't help him. He's got all the establishment with him, and the Republican voters are not, they're not being moved by this. So while Larry and I agree that the idea of a contested convention is very unlikely, it's who knows how people are going to feel in a few months. I mean, by late August, people, if things are falling apart, and I wonder how Mitt Romney's going to be feeling by then, too.
Yeah,
I see him taking the nomination in California, but...
Oh, I think it's going to be, depending upon, I think it could be very spirited in the state. Because remember, who knows? It's we have what's known as an open primary now. We don't know to what extent the Democrats want to fiddle with it. Of course, that assumes Democrats are organized, and Democrats and organized don't go together very well. But I think California would be very spirited if this thing is still tied up.
But Republicans can only vote for the presidential, even though it's a top two primary. That's how it works. So as much as one likes to think of mischief in this particular case,
it's not like Michigan.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Good point. Santorum asked for Democrats too.
That's correct.
All the more reason, by the way, then that I think Santorum could do very well, because if you look at the Republicans in the state, especially, in the Central Valley and in Orange County, places like that, there's a lot of evangelical Republicans down there. Mm-hmm. The land of Robert Shuler and all those folks, and I think that he could do pretty well, Santorum.
I have to let me tell you why I don't believe that will happen. I think California Republican voters are very smart. That's why they picked John McCain in 2008, even though the system was rigged to get Romney in. And Rick Santorum, did you see? He just went to Puerto Rico and said that Puerto Rico becomes a state, that they have to make English the official language. I'm sorry.
We can call that primary right now, right?
I think we can call that primary right now.
That's winner take all.
Is it a winner take all?
Yeah, it's one of the few winner take all. 20 delegates like that, boy, goodbye. Yeah.
So I just don't, I don't see Rick Santorum being a strong player in California.
Okay. Well, this sounds like a movie title, but what about Newt?
Okay.
How is he looking after that, and is he effectively...
Deborah, have some
thermometer.
I do not want Newt Gingrich to be the nominee. I have written many columns about why I believe he is not worthy as the nominee. And I saw him a couple weeks ago when he was in California. He looked tired. He knows it's over. He's going to keep running. He doesn't care what's going to happen with the party. He's got Sheldon Adelson putting his millions into the super PAC that... helps keep his candidacy going. And
why is he running?
He's run. Continuing. It's ego. I mean, this. Why? Newt Gingrich, when he was Speaker of the House, had an out-of-control ego. It led him. I mean, Republican members, when Newt was Speaker, would pick up the paper and say, "Oh no, what do I have to apologize for Newt saying today?" He was just so much work for them that they got rid of him. And now he's had all those years to lick his wounds since then. It's been, 12, 13 years since he was Speaker? And this is his one, he doesn't want to die wondering if he could have been president. So?
Now he knows.
Now he knows. Yeah.
Are either of them, I'm assuming from your what you just said, that Newt definitely is not, but is Santorum a possible running mate for Romney? Or do you think he would look for one of those other folks you were mentioning?
There would be no benefit that I see to taking someone like Santorum. Marco Rubio, Florida, kind of young. But other than that, that's a nice state, you know, fourth largest number of delegates. That's good. I don't think Chris Christie, because they're too close in terms of proximity. Maybe Rick Perry. Maybe. I think Romney could do better than that. I think he could do better.
I don't think Santorum's necessarily going to win Pennsylvania. So that takes care of that. If Mitt Romney can, I mean, there. Of course, Mitt Romney thought he was going to win states before and didn't. But there's speculation that that he can't even take his own state, just as he lost the last time he ran for the Senate. You want to know who I think would be?
Who do you want, and who do you think will get it?
Who do I want? Oh, there's just no point in going there.
Oh, come on.
Well, I'd love to see somebody like Chris Christie or Paul Ryan. I love Paul Ryan, the House Budget Chairman. I think he'd be fantastic. I mean, there are a lot of good picks. I think, but I'll give you, Marco Rubio has many things going for him. A lot of Latinos don't consider him to be Latino because he's Cuban. I don't know how that plays out. I'm sure that there are people who have crunched all the numbers and know better than I. I think Rand Paul could be the pick. I think he could be the pick because if I were Mitt Romney, I'm looking at that Ron Paul vote. Ron Paul has a robust young vote and young Republican vote, and those people are going to be dissatisfied. We were here last month, I asked people, how many people here know somebody who voted for Obama who this year wanted to vote or voted for Rand Paul? Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. There's this weird, so I think it's, and as you know, Mrs. Romney and Mrs. Paul are buddies, and they haven't, you know, Ron Paul hasn't been too tough on Mitt Romney on the trail. So I think Rand Paul's a real possibility. Maybe Nikki Haley from South Carolina. One other person I think would be sort of interesting would be Tom Coburn. The senator from Oklahoma, he's a doctor, and he's really good on these fiscal issues.
I can't see Ron Paul because he's uncontrollable.
Rand Paul.
I'm sorry?
Rand Paul.
Rand Paul, the senator.
No, of course. Did I say that wrong?
You said Rand, but they sound alike.
I was already programmed. Yeah.
I wondered. I saw a few people looking, and I wondered, okay, now I get it.
Got it. Yeah.
Rand Paul.
Got
so what do you think of Rand Paul?
He's sharp. He's young. And I think he's got a lot of his father's gifts without the liabilities.
And his seat would likely
I think Paul Ryan, of all of them, talk about a smart guy,
yes.
You know, who knows how to talk to people, who knows how to tell the story. That's the key. You know, money stuff, appropriations, taxes, that. Yeah, he knows how to tell the story. I think he's terrific for the Republicans. Nikki Haley, however, in my mind, would be a wonderful choice simply because they've got a 20-point gender gap. Mm-hmm. You know? I mean, I'm sorry. Other than you, Deborah, no female wants to align themselves with the Republicans right now. You know, they've just stepped in it over and over again. And bringing on Nikki Haley would go a long way towards suturing some of those open wounds.
Except, as we all know, Larry, by the time they're through with her, she won't really be a woman anymore.
Let's.
I'm talking about the way Democrats will be talking about her, not Republicans.
That alone.
Can you face the audience, please?
Oh, sorry. Are we?
Are we?
I have to sort of read lips.
That's it.
Okay.
Well, let's do an exit question, if you will, on the GOP race. And that is, what's the next big test or the next big step? Is it the Illinois primary? Is it going to be, I forget what's right after that. You know, what will be the next test that we'll kind of see, okay, that's a significant victory or loss by probably Romney or Santorum? Deborah?
I'm not paying attention for another week
or
two.
Right.
I'm not doing it. I'm not looking. I'm gonna
look, Illinois is Tuesday, and then you have some states that are fairly friendly to Romney. But let's remember, The Republicans have done this year more than ever what the Democrats have done for 20 years, and that's the whole idea of proportional representation. So you can get 25% of the vote, you know, and lose and still get somewhere around 25% of the delegates. You know, that, and that's part of the problem for Romney. If you look at all the delegates out there, he's got just a skosh more than half. Very, very uncomfortable. That's because of the proportional representation stuff. So, you know, Illinois, I think, should be fairly favorable to Romney. It's a more sophisticated electorate. It's a more educated electorate. You know, there's a big Chicago suburban vote there for Romney. Santorum will do well with the downstate folks, but there are not enough of them to counter. So I would think they'd be handicapped for Romney. And then there's a series of states on the East Coast after that. But I mean, it's a grinder. It's a grinder. And like we said earlier, probably he'll have it. But boy, he is limping into this thing. And unlike with the Democrats in 2008, when so many Democrats I know said, geez, I like Obama. I wish I could vote for Hillary. Geez, I like Hillary. I wish I could vote for Obama. You know, they were torn this way. The Republicans saying, I don't like him. I don't like him. I don't like him. I don't like him. Where's the right end? You know, and that's the difference. The animus, you know, wow, save that for the Democrats, you guys. You know, don't shoot it all now. So I worry about that. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's move on. California Governor Jerry Brown reportedly has struck a deal. Those are air quotes for those of you listening to this on the computer. Struck a deal with proponents behind another of the ballot initiatives regarding these millionaire tax referenda that we are facing. Larry, is he making some headway in getting some clarity to what he wants and seeing a path to getting his policies implemented on this or not?
Jerry Brown is so different now than he was 36 years ago. 36 years ago, he would have said, it's my way or the highway. Too bad. But he is, you know, I guess he's a late bloomer. He's finally figured out that you got to work with people. He saw the polls. I guess it was Field, the most recent, that showed his proposal not doing as well. There's also a real populist element to soaking the rich, if you will. I happen to think that the idea of increasing, I'm editorializing here, increasing income taxes isn't so good because we get so much of our revenue already from the income tax. Not that that's a bad tax. So we need to find other ways, other revenue streams. That's not your question. Yeah, he's found it necessary to construct a hybrid in terms of the California Federation of Teachers proposal and his. They will get in bed together, so to speak, and hopefully for their sake push it through. I think it's going to be an uphill battle. But I think as people begin to see the disastrous state of California's budget, far worse than anybody wants to talk about, I think it has a good shot.
I think it fails.
There you go.
I think it fails for a few reasons.
Meaning it fails at the polls?
Yes. Okay. Well, by the way, it's still not entirely clear how this is going to work because when the CFT, California Federation of Teachers, and Jerry Brown cut this deal, they have very little time to get the signatures. So they're still out each getting signatures for their other measures. And the deal could fall through. Here's the problem with Jerry, and Jerry Brown knows this. He understands, I mean, Larry, you mentioned that income tax it just is weighted so heavily in our tax structure. The top 1% of California taxpayers pay anywhere from 38 to 49% of the whole state's income tax. That's 1%. Now, these folks can leave. They're not like me with a mortgage and a job, and if I don't like things, it's still going to cost me a lot of money to get out of here. If you're somebody who's making $20 million a year, and you're facing and I should explain what they're doing, but let me just finish my point. You have three homes, you can move into another one of them in another state. And a lot of people who are making a lot of money feel pretty squeezed right now. California has the second highest rate for affluent people in the country. Basically, the CFT wanted to tax soak the rich by adding an extra 5% onto their income taxes. that's basically increasing their income tax by half almost, because the high rate is about 10.3%. Jerry Brown had a deal which was part half sales tax increase, 1 to 2% increase on highest earners. The deal is that it's a quarter cent increase on the sales tax and up to 3% on millionaires. Now, in compromise, that sounds okay. Well, they split the difference. The problem is that what we're telling people who have assets is every time the state legislature overspends, we're going to go to your pockets to take care of the problem. And that is, I think, really dangerous to the state. Wall Street Journal had a great editorial a few weeks ago about Detroit and how Detroit was an incredibly affluent city with lots of rich people. And part of the problem that it had is you start taxing the rich too much and they leave. They don't have to stay. Jerry Brown knows this, doesn't want to say it. It's not, as Larry would put it, the populist thing to do. But it's not going to be good for the state. And if it passes, it will just make the dysfunctional nature of our state finance system get worse.
Yeah, and just to footnote that, I mean, not only do the wealthy pay the disproportionate share of income taxes, but income taxes in general account for about 56% of the general fund. Okay, sales tax about 25%, and you go down the line from there. So when things go well, money floods in. And when you get into a recession, it goes away. And that kind of roller coaster says a lot about the dysfunctionality of California's budget process. We need to find more ways of spreading the burden so that it doesn't just come from one source. I'm not suggesting we need to cut taxes. I actually think we need to raise taxes, plenty. But it can't be from this one source.
Well, and part of the problems we have with budgeting have to do with a number of decisions that have been made in the course of propositions and, you know, statewide things. And we've got two more coming up, at least two more, in the June election.
Two.
Prop 29, which would increase the cigarette tax by a dollar. Prop 28, which, I don't know, I think of it as rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. It'll make some minor modifications in our state term limit laws, and you now understand about as much of it as I do. Larry, you really understand this stuff. What are these? What's going on with these?
Well,
two?
The deal with 29 is to raise, as John said, taxes on cigarettes by $1 per pack. California ranks 33rd in the nation when it comes to tobacco taxes. So we're hardly, in terms of everybody else, taxing cigarettes much. The last time we increased cigarette tax, I think, was 1991, 92, something like that, with 50 cents a pack. But the deal is it would raise $850 million a year. Well, you know what? In a state that badly needs revenue, go back to what I just said, you've got to find different ways of bringing in revenue. Terrific, hunky-dory, let's do it. Here's the rub. The money must be used for children's cancer research. Okay? Excuse me. What about education? What about this? What about that? No, no, no. The money is earmarked. Just like when we passed Proposition 63 some years ago, tacking on 1% to the income tax, the money, several billion dollars a year, I forgot how much it is exactly, maybe a billion and a half, is dedicated only to certain types of mental health programs. Proposition 42 a couple of years ago said the gasoline tax must be spent for transportation and roads. You put all these things together, and you're now talking about 70% of the state budget that is already determined before they even look at it. Well, you begin to see why everybody's hands are tied. So that's the good news, bad news. You know, it's wonderful, you know, but on the other side, you've got a problem in terms of the way that the tax is structured in terms of its use.
Deborah, what do you... Are you paying attention to the state taxes for the next couple of years?
I think Larry's just on the money on this. And voters, the problem that we have with the initiative system is that voters are always happy to tax somebody else, and they are happier to tax somebody else for a, you know, pet cause. But that's why Sacramento has so much trouble balancing the budget. It's tough.
And I do think that it could be in trouble for another reason. That's the tobacco industry. Tobacco industry, this kind of issue came up a few years ago. The tobacco industry spent $65 $65 million to defeat, I think it was Proposition 86. So I mean, they're really good at mobilizing. They've already socked away $15 million in campaign contributions against about 2 or 3 million that the Yes folks have done. So I think when the end comes, it will be swift, and it'll have a very difficult time passing.
Interesting. You mentioned the using it to make someone else pay for things, and someone asked the question of Proposition 13, if that was kind of the root of all evil here, which is basically saying, we're not going to pay for this. It's got to come out from other things. Is that... Is Proposition 13 going to be around forever, or does that get...
Longer.
Longer?
Yeah. I understand why people blame Proposition 13, but there are so many measures on the ballot that have limited how and what and where we can spend things, that, and there's no political will to change it. So that's just... It's self-indulgent to complain about Prop 13 when there are other more doable remedies. One thing, don't sign any more. Next time you see a signature gatherer, don't sign it. Just don't. Just tell them you've taken a pledge.
The Deborah Saunders pledge, I will not sign. Well, very good. Let's move on then. Now, a decade ago, I lived in Chicago, Illinois. That's a city and a state not exactly known for good official conduct. In fact, you apparently have a better chance of going to jail if you're a governor of that state than if you commit murder. It's apparently true. In fact, if you're a governor and you want to avoid going to prison, you should probably commit murder. I don't know. But anyway, I suspect they're getting a little bit of schadenfreude out of what is actually a serious situation here in San Francisco, where we have our sheriff who just pled guilty. I know you've written about this, Deborah. Mm-hmm. What should the mayor do? I mean, is it kind of on his doorstep to push something, or do you think pressure on the sheriff will force the issue?
Well, let's look at three events that we can look forward to in the future. Look forward is the word. On Monday, as we know, Sheriff Mercurimi pleaded guilty to, forced?
Yeah.
False imprisonment, yeah. Thank you. This coming Monday, he's going to be sentenced. The District Attorney George Gascon came into the Chronicle editorial board this week and made clear his unhappiness with some remarks that the sheriff had made to Matirin Ross at the Chronicle. And they're going to tell the judge, let's make it clear that he says that he is guilty. Having done that, I think the sheriff owes the city of San Francisco an explanation as to what happened on New Year's Eve weekend at his house. And we'll see if he does that. His attorney told me he's going to do it after the sentencing is done on Monday. And then we'll see what kind of pressure there is on the mayor. I'm not sure what I would do if I were the mayor. I originally wrote that I thought that people shouldn't go after him. He was innocent until proven guilty. Now he's pleaded guilty. But also, I've had questions about this case. The worst that they basically have accused him of doing is grabbing his wife's arm and leaving a bruise, doing so in front of their son, and telling her, I don't want you talking to people. I don't know if we really want to prosecute that kind of case. I know what domestic violence people say, and I completely respect it, which is so many of these cases, they start out with something like this, and the guys get worse. But in this country, we try somebody for what they've done, not what they might do. Mm-hmm. And in this plea, it's not officially a domestic violence plea, although part of the plea bargain is that he has domestic violence counseling. The voters of San Francisco elected him. Chances are he's going to stay, and we'll see how people feel later. How they'll feel about him as sheriff, however, will depend on his actions, and I think he really has to come clean with people.
You know, it's so funny because we talked about ego before in Newt Gingrich. Well, sort of the opposite end of this is contrition. And mm-hmm. Americans are incredibly forgiving when somebody says, I messed up. I was wrong. You know, whether it was grabbing her arm, whatever. I shouldn't have done it. Another way to talk. Another way to communicate. Blah, blah, blah. He does that, and I think he's going to be given an awful lot of room. If he doesn't, the ego thing again, the hubris. If he doesn't, then I think we're going to have a problem where, you know, he could well be a one-term sheriff. But I agree with you. I'm true to him, very sensitive to these issues. But you have to look at what the charges are. You also have to look at the politics around it, the animus between the DA and the sheriff, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, it's not quite so cut and dry in terms of the seriousness of the charges. And so when in doubt, I think you give a little bit of room. How he manages it from here, it'll be interesting to see.
Well, let's talk about a different apology that some of you may have heard about recently. A radio guy, I think his name is Rush Limbaugh, recently apologized. I'll not repeat what he said, that what he was apologizing for. But as a result of that controversy, of course, he has lost about somewhere north of 140 advertisers. I believe these are the local advertisers, not the ones who do the national buys, for his syndicated radio program. And one of his unexpected defenders has been liberal comedian and commentator Bill Maher, who himself knows more than a little about being kind of the being pilloried for having made inflammatory public statements. And Maher told people that, look, Limbaugh apologized, accept it. And now, Maher was not defending what Limbaugh had said, but he was basically standing on a very basic free speech thing of, look, you may not like what he has to say, you have every right to call him names for what he has to say, but, you know, I think Bill Maher seemed very upset at attempts to silence him. And the reason I'm bringing this up here is really kind of the political aspect. We did see the Republican candidates, of course, all had to make a statement, but George Will criticize them for not being forthright enough and just saying, look, this is a terrible thing. What do you think, I mean, does this loosen some of the alleged control of Limbaugh over kind of the Republican narrative, if I can get too meta? I mean, is he still Mr. Republican in many ways?
So I'm the worst person to ask about this because I get called those names every week. And I find that there's this completely phony industry of umbrage in this country where Rush Limbaugh says something about Sandra Fluke, totally inappropriate what he said about her, I won't repeat it, and the worst part about what he said about her was that she's a civilian, right? Bill Maher has used the kind of crude language to which most of you are not familiar. I get it regularly. They both have potty mouth problems, yeah. All right? But this idea that, the older I get, the less I write about these things because they're all manufactured. Limbaugh says this. Everybody has to say that they don't like it. So then the Republicans say, well, Maher said this, so the Obama super PAC has to return the money. It's so phony. It's not, there are real serious issues in this country, and This is just for people who like to get angry.
Yeah, let's get over it. But I think that the larger issue is the lack of civility in American politics these days. And you don't have to look to Rush Limbaugh or Bill Maher. It's all over the place. And I mean, you know, I see people like Olympia Snowe, you know, retiring. Gosh, you know, we need about 20 more of her, you know, in the Senate, you know, because, you know, she's a decent, a thoughtful, I guess I could use the word moderate Republican. I don't think she's conservative about a lot of issues, but she never says things that are inflammatory. She works with the other side. We don't see that very much these days, and that bothers me much more than the Limbaugh thing or Maher. I mean, there has to be a tone in politics where at the end of the day you work to govern, you find common ground somewhere somehow. And there's not a lot of that right now, and I'm really afraid that at the end of this election cycle, nothing much will have changed. That really has me worried.
Well, let's switch gears here a bit. First, a reminder, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our week-to-week panelists today are Deborah J. Saunders, Dr. Larry Gersten, and Brian Caulfield. I'm your host, John Zipperer. Now I'd like to bring up onto our stage Brian Caulfield. You can join us, Brian. Brian is a San Francisco-based technology reporter for Forbes and Forbes.com. Why don't you take the seat right there?
Thanks.
And welcome to Week, Brian.
Yeah, well, it won't solve your political problems. Bill will do anything else you want. The iPad goes on sale today, and what is there to say? Apple sold 55 million of them. If you call it a personal computer, and it is very personal, and it is very much a computer, Apple is now the largest personal computer vendor on the planet, which is pretty remarkable, amazing considering where they were 10 years ago.
Isn't there something about how they're either already are or are estimated to, in the near future, sell more of the iOS, the operating system, than the actual hardware on whatever platform? Is that...
Yeah, they make, I think, if I remember right, 73% of their revenues come from the iPod Touch, the iPad, the iPhone. So they're about these mobile devices right now more than the Mac. And it's part of a larger shift because last year smartphones began outselling PCs. So we're in a world dominated by the smartphone, and the iPad is an interesting hybrid because it combines a larger form factor than your average smartphone, but has a smartphone processor, a smartphone IS, an instant-on capability, mm-hmm. and people love it.
You wrote, I believe it was today on Forbes.com, about how, yes, there are these long lines of folks out standing in the rain outside the Apple store today buying their iPad 3s, but there's an increasing number of them who are buying them, in fact, online, as a friend of ours did. My take on the make people line up has always been that was to help feed into the hype event of it, to give good visuals of, look how many we can wrap people around the block to buy this thing that they could buy in dry weather if they waited 3 days or order online. So is this a change in tactic by Apple, or is their supply chain just allowing them to do those advance orders?
Well, first, I think you've got a great point. Apple knows theater, and their co-founder Steve Jobs knew theater like no one else. So it was a bit of theater. Mm-hmm. But it's also because demand is so big now that they needed to spread these out a little more in order to sell the units they need to keep up with demand. So you can find them at Radio Shack, you can find them at Walmart, you can find them at Best Buy. They're just in too many places for people to line up anymore. And they have too many outlets. So you're just not going to see the kind of mass mob phenomenon that we saw with other launches because it's just too, you know, it's been dumped into the water supply. Let's hope it doesn't kill us all. Let's hope it's good for us because it's out there. You're soaking in it.
Yes. Well, they can wrap it around a Nike shoe and then they'll have their bigger lines again. I guess they're going for the same sort of thing. So let's talk about the iPad 3 itself. The big selling point, I guess, so far that I've heard has been the so-called Retina display. Is that really a big advance? Is that just kind of what they're touting because there isn't really anything else big in it? I mean, what kind of an advance over the iPad 2 is this?
I think that's it. And so it's not a big advance, and yes, it is. The display is wonderful. It's better than an HD TV. You will notice a difference. It's beautiful, but it doesn't do anything new. It's basically a tablet computer. We all know the form factor. We know how it works. No one be shocked by it. It's just a little quicker. The screen is a lot prettier. The camera's a little better. And to drive all of that, they've put a bigger battery in it and a slightly more powerful processor.
Is it heavier or lighter?
It's slightly heavier, slightly thicker. You will notice a difference if you use an iPad more than you should. But it's still thinner than the original iPad.
Here, take a look. Now, Kindle allegedly was making some inroads into this whole tablet area with their latest versions, and the Nook has their top of the line that they're kind of hoping will be competitive. Who do you kind of see as the big competitors of the iPad? Is it, you mentioned, I believe, the Dell offering that they're working on. You wrote recently about Dell moving into the enterprise business space with something. Who do you think are the best competitors?
I think Amazon. I mean, their business model is so radically different, which is sell the hardware, make no profit, even a little bit of loss, and hope to make it up on content and on shopping. Mm-hmm. I think it's a great device, but the user experience is not in the same league. It's frustrating. It's slow. It's not as well thought out. It's not as well put together. But it's a lot cheaper. And if you use Amazon all the time, then you're going to want one.
Yeah.
But and so they're going to sell a lot of units. But really, there isn't any competition out there that's really serious right now. Dell is interesting only because they are so good at getting into the IT shop and convincing those IT guys that you know how to use our stuff and manage our stuff. You're familiar with Windows. We sell you thousands of hundreds of tens of thousands of these units for your companies every day. You'll be able to manage these when they're in the workforce. That's what Dell can promise. But they haven't done that in the tablet space yet.
Nokia announced that they're in the process of working on a tablet. Is that just a bunch of puffery?
I think Nokia's got to turn things around. They've had a really bad couple of years, but you're right. They're very credible because Windows Microsoft's tablet operating system is beautiful. It's well thought out. It's well designed. Amazingly enough, it actually looks good. The problem is, you pick it up and you play with it, and everyone already knows how to use a smartphone. And it's a very different design. It's a very different user experience. So if you're used to an iPhone or even an Android, you pick it up and you're like, how do I use this? What do I do? This is a different paradigm. And why do you need to relearn how to do all these things when you already know how to use a smartphone? But Nokia, what they do with tablets and what they do with Microsoft will be really interesting to watch because it is a good product.
In Walter Isaacson's book about Steve Jobs, he wrote about how when Steve Jobs started going to the record industry, charging them 30%, that in a way it saved the record industry. Is one who works in the newspaper industry
sees there's no sales salvation for that.
And sees Apple getting 30%, which is twice what an agent gets. I'm not so grateful. Do other concerns feel that way?
I think in the entertainment business, movie studios are real leery of giving Apple too much power, and you can almost sense them looking through other options. This is why there has been some noise about Intel maybe doing a set-top box that will stream movies and music in a secure way. Intel's got great technology, but not because Intel's proven that it can do this, but because the people who own the content are are rather smart despite their bad track record over the past 10 years, and they want another option. They don't want to get trapped or boxed in. Right now, it looks like they are boxed in.
All of these big tech companies, of course, sue each other left and right. someone just said something. Yahoo is suing Facebook this week. I'm wondering if that's just an attempt to try to hold up their IPO. Google and Apple and Samsung and Apple have been having a knockdown, drag-out legal fight around the world. Saw again on your stuff you write that Samsung, on the other hand, is making some of the components of the new iPad. Am I right about that?
Yeah. They make the display, and Apple and Samsung have a delightfully dysfunctional relationship that if you're used to Mexican soap operas will be incredibly familiar. There's a lot of yelling, there's a lot of lawsuits, there's a lot of intermixing of technologies and parts. Mm-hmm. For a long time, they made the processor that powered the iPad. They make a lot of the memory for a lot of these devices. They make the display for the iPad. The wonderful thing about all these arrangements is you don't know what's in there until someone cracks it open and looks inside and they said, oh my God, it's a Samsung display. How do you know?
And that's what happened on this. Did they go on sale first in Australia? And tell us about that, because wasn't there someone who actually flew over there for the purpose of buying it and opening it up?
There's a whole industry of horrible, horrible people who live to buy these new gadgets and destroy them, tear them apart and get the most... It's like an episode of Saw. They get sanders and x-rays and sharp knives and suction cups, and they tear these apart, and they tell you what's inside, and this moves stock prices, because if you find a power management device from Fairchild Semiconductor in San Jose, which sells for 75 cents, is in there, they're going to sell 10 million of these, and it's going to move that stock. So people have, they're not just doing this for fun. You find out, Broadcom, Qualcomm are going to make a lot of money on this. And Apple never says a word about what's in these things until they put it on sale. So it's like an Easter egg hunt.
So anyone who's associated with a really hot product like this has a chance of kind of going through the roof for at least their 15 minutes of fame.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's going to be a substantial pop. Fairchild, which is this really old company, they've been around. There's nothing, no knock on Fairchild. There is nothing sexy about this company, nothing. They make power management stuff. I mean, it's like making a transmission on a truck. They had their stock went up 4.5% because they're selling, you know, 75 cents parts, probably 10, 12 million of them this year.
Are there any estimates for how many of these iPads they're expecting to sell?
Yeah, they're all over the place, and they're almost always wrong. Wall Street analysts, they love to be a little conservative. I've seen estimates of 12 million, and I think that's conservative. I think there'll be more than 12 million sold easily.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. I've been interested in what Apple does as it rolls out a new product that is kind of accredited with, you know, defining a whole new market niche, you know,
yeah.
The iPod, blah, blah, blah. And really what they're doing is they're taking a storage device, a portable storage device, and finding something new to put on it. And
absolutely.
You know, there's anyone else could have done it who has billions of dollars, but it's not so much that, I've invented portable music devices. No, I've seen a way to make this a better portable music device. Similarly, Google and Amazon have tons of the most boring commodity in the world, which is storage. And so they turned around and said, we can sell that. We can rent this storage, computer storage space out to folks. And again, cloud computing becomes this huge enterprise level business. Is there any sense, and there is actual a question after all this, is there any sense that Apple, you know, obviously in the post-Jobs era, can keep that innovation line going, continuing to look at really their assets and saying, what else can we do with this that will be, you know, the next iPod, iPhone, iPad?
Yeah, I think you made a great point earlier that they don't come up with fundamental breakthrough innovations in material science or the hardware. They don't invent a radically new form of technology. They simply are really smart about riding trends, like they've rode the trend towards flat, cheap displays beautifully, towards solid state, cheap storage beautifully. They didn't invent any of these things. And someone who would know once told me that the secret to Apple is it's really a software company. So they merely make software that makes all of these new kinds of hardware that everyone else is manufacturing work better, work more simply, and make it more accessible to more people. And I don't see that changing. I think they're going to, if someone invents a radically new form of display or technology or a power source, they're going to make it more usable than anyone because they know how to make the software mm-hmm. that makes you want to pick that up and play with it.
Very good. Now is a good time to open this up to you folks. If anyone has a question, maybe you've asked a question on paper and I didn't get to read it, go ahead and line up behind the microphone there. We'll get you in for the next few minutes. In the meantime, do you have an iPad?
I have the original model, the iPad 1.
You have to like wind it up and...
Yeah, it's almost steampunk now. It's heavy, it's made out of metal. My kid grabs it, she chews on it. It's like medieval.
Indestructible.
Yeah, I could like go into politics with it and like bop people over the head. Down, Gingrich, bam. But it's solid. And these new ones, they feel like, you know, they're like a piece of paper.
And are these made again in, or we all assume everything now from Apple is made at Foxconn in China? Or do they have a wider manufacturing base?
Yeah, Foxconn almost certainly does the assembly for this one. And but, you know, they also farm out different chunks of, like, Samsung will do the display.
Yeah.
Texas Instruments will do digital, will do other parts. Qualcomm will do the modem. So, it's assembled from various places. But, yeah, Foxconn almost certainly does the final assembly of that thing.
Very good. Do we have a question?
Yes, back to the election. I heard that Romney's already spent $40 million of his own money, and it's disgusting that money's so powerful in American elections, and I just wondered what we could do about it and what you thought.
I think the figure you're referring to is the $42 million he loaned himself in the 2008 campaign.
Oh, that's right.
He has not spent any of his money
this campaign.
Then I apologize, but it still strikes me that money plays way too much a role, and the electorate must be very gullible if it works.
A couple of quick things to that. I don't know how we can ever get rid of money in politics. I've thought about this for 40 years and still coming up nothing. It's just part of the DNA. Certainly people would not want to spend $2 or $3 billion of public money to run a presidential election. They just wouldn't. We know that. And so you have it this way. I think there are issues with the super PACs that are troublesome, not because of them per se, but only because of the mystery behind them. And we don't have access to who's doing what. I think that's a more serious issue for me.
Getting money out of politics, it's like getting sex out of entertainment.
Yeah, won't work.
Just not going to happen.
Yeah. Okay. And by the way, one other thing, we tend to think that money always buys an election. Meg Whitman might have something to say about that. Those things are kind of refreshing.
Yes, another question.
Yes, when we were talking about the taxes and you were saying that the rich could get up and leave California, I'm from Napa, all right? I've lived in both New York, down south, Seattle, beautiful places. I live in Seattle, when I lived in Seattle and it rained, we didn't use umbrellas, all right? But when you're saying the rich could get up and move any place, I could move from Napa to Vallejo and get a house down there for $30,000. But would I live in Vallejo?
You could buy Vallejo for $30,000.
I could buy Vallejo. So. Yeah, and you're saying, they're going to get up and move. Okay, there are other places, but California's pretty nice to live in.
I love California. I've lived here for 1985. I love it here. But let me just say, it's very easy to say how other people should act when they get squeezed this much. And if you're somebody who makes a lot of money in this tax hike, and you feel like we're paying 50% of California's income tax, and now you're going to double my tax squeeze, which is what the CFT would have done.
Now, after your accountant has given you a corporation, or IRS, or you have turned into...
It would have gone from 10% to 15%. Now the top rate will go from 10% to 13% if the Brown CFT plan goes through. That's a 30% hike in your income tax. Now I get your point. I'll just tell you, it doesn't take a lot of millionaires leaving to make a huge dent in how much. I mean, I'm talking about really rich people. I'm talking about gazillionaire types, right? I'm talking about Meg Whitmans. It doesn't take a whole lot of them moving to put a huge dent in our coffers. You're killing the goose that laid the golden egg. But you can feel differently.
No, the way I'm feeling about it is I'm redoing my house. I'm willing to pay the carpenter a little bit more money before I buy from China. So if I'm looking at a millionaire, multimillionaire, and they're saying, gosh, I could throw away maybe $100 million and not feel it. They're not feeling this money on a car that's not even made in America. Maybe they'll say, well, gosh, yeah, I can spread it around a little bit. Otherwise, I'm looking at them as being pretty money hungry for a fraction of their income. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you. Yes, sir.
This is simple. Is there any hope for reducing government spending either on the federal level or the state level?
Is that kind of like getting sex out of entertainment?
Is there any hope? I suppose there's always hope. If you look at, this is not going to be popular, what I'm going to say, but then I always have, if I don't tick off everybody by the end of a lecture, I've failed. So what I'm going to say is going to be in that theme. This is not a high taxing country. If you look at all the other countries around, it's extremely low taxing. It is not a high spending government. If you look at all the other ones around, I know it seems like that. It all seems like it comes right from us, but it isn't. I mean, the data are the data. That's all there is to it. In this state, particularly. If you look at various policy areas, we are near bottom if you look at spending. If you look at the state bureaucracy in terms of leanness, it is the most lean or next to most lean, depending upon what study you look at, of any other state. So, you know, we have 38 million people here with 38 million problems times something. And it's a very difficult state to manage for a variety of reasons, all the way from the incredible number of languages we speak to the diverse topography, to the industries here that in some way or another have a fairly large grasp of perks and whatnot. And there's a lot of different things, but I mean, it's not really a high spending state or nation. We might quibble about what is spent on what. We could have an argument about whether we're spending too much in defense or not enough on this or that. But in terms of dollars, it just isn't.
I'll just say that's a worry for me, because we know that we keep, every year you hear about how they're cutting $15 billion out of the state budget, but they still spend more every year. And if the tax measure that Jerry Brown and CFT put forward fails, Jerry Brown has said when he ran for office that if people don't want to pay higher taxes, he will cut, and that would make the state government get down. I worry about what's going on in the federal government. I worry about Republicans who keep telling everybody that we have to keep lowering the tax rates. I want to lower some of the tax rates, but we still have to get more revenue in. And I mean, Larry and I think agree with this, at least to some extent. But we've got this. Everybody in America seems to think that we should, that only somebody else should pay for the government that we have, and it's only the rich people who should pay. I shouldn't have to pay, and it concerns me a great deal that we have a president, a Democratic president, and a Republican field challenging him. Both of whom are telling people, you don't have to pay for anymore. You shouldn't have to. In fact, you should pay less. And they're both doing it. And it is not good. And we are going to have huge debt. And it is going to be a big problem. And then maybe we'll deal with it.
On that happy note, do we have another question?
Yeah, I'll make it real quick. Pulling back in terms of the politics of the Republicans and the Democrats, it's always been my impression that Karl Rove has been the puppet master throughout the Bush administration. And in the sense that Obama is basically a spotless candidate in many respects to try to attack on any personal level, has the Republican Party, through someone like Rove, gone to this strategy of attacking cultural issues? Needless to say, what they've been from gays, women, health, all this stuff, because they have basically an empty hand.
You want to go? As a spokesperson for Republicans?
The Democrats keep poking Republicans until they bring up cultural issues. A lot of Republicans don't want it, don't necessarily want to do it. And believe me, Republicans have been hitting Barack Obama on plenty of issues where he is vulnerable. His poor leadership on the budget, his I would say questionable energy policies. There are a lot of things. He'll probably win re-election, but I wouldn't bet my farm on it.
I think cultural issues are good for Republicans because that's what a lot of the base is about. You know, the evangelical portion of the Republican Party is very, very important. You know, and if you can stoke the flames of the base, that goes a long way toward getting people out, you know, to, you know, talk to others about voting, to knock on doors, to do all those retail things that, you know, we don't like to think about, but are very much a part of the political process. I'm not surprised by any of it, particularly as the economy improves. You know, as the economy improves, you have to look for other things. So Deborah talked about leadership. You know, I think that becomes a reasonable Republican idea to talk about leadership. He hasn't really or pick on the Democrats in the Senate for not passing a budget. I think there are things they can do. But culture, that's good stuff. I mean, you know, I mean, from the Republican point of view, I mean, I just think it is. And it's handy. It's a handy tool in the tool chest to pull out, because it gets people angry and motivated to participate. You know, right? That's part of politics.
I think we have time for one more question. Are you, sir?
Yeah, I have a tech question. It seems to me that right now we have cell phones, we have the iPad, we've got PC, and everybody's got to have three different machines. My question to you is, what direction is it going to be? Are we going to eventually be able to buy one machine, or are we going to have to keep buying three?
I love that idea of buying just one machine. I wish. I don't see that happening anytime soon. You can do things on a notebook you can't do with an iPad. If you want to do a spreadsheet or heavy-duty photo editing, you're going to need a notebook. But so I think we might go to two devices, where some consumers, they need a smartphone and a tablet or light-duty notebook if they don't do a lot of computer work. So maybe we'll get down to the point where we have two major categories, you know, in the next decade.
Okay. Well, let's do our news quiz here in our last few minutes. I'm going to ask some questions. Raise your hand if you think you know the answer. I'll point at you, just shout it out. Nice and informal. So our question, number one. The state of California gave some bad news to thousands of its employees this week. Who were they and what were they told? That's right. 20,000 California public school teachers received pink slips. These actually are preliminary notices letting them know they might be out of a job in the fall. So, question number two. The case of a Rutgers University student accused of hate crimes for actions that preceded his roommate's suicide, that case ended today. Do you know what the jury's conclusion was? That's right. They convicted the defendant, and I believe it's Darun Ravi, I might have mispronounced that, earlier today, in fact, for using a webcam to spy on his roommate. I believe the argument was that he was motivated in doing that because his roommate was gay. Question number three. Just when things were going so well for Mitt Romney, the New York Times is reporting a new potential problem related to his past business. Did any of you see this? Yes, sir. Bain Capital, secrecy in China, that's right. The paper reports that Bain Capital stands to profit handsomely from massive domestic camera surveillance systems that the Chinese Communist government is putting into place. So, next question. Now, this man might have been hiding in a suburban home glued to his television, but Osama bin Laden was still busy planning more acts. Who was his highest profile target? I'll give you a hint. The killing still happened, but it happened in reverse. That's right. The Washington Post reports that U.S. Navy SEALs found documents in bin Laden's compound showing that he had ordered attacks on the aircraft of President Obama and of General David Petraeus. So, fourth question. Just days after being a guest at a White House state dinner for the British Prime Minister, someone was arrested during a protest at the Embassy of Sudan in Washington, D.C. George Clooney, that's right.
I wish I could have done that.
Arrested him or done the protest? Well, Clooney, of course, is well known for speaking up about the genocide in Sudan, so.
And being unfairly handsome.
Prison will take care of that. Okay. Final question. And I'll be impressed if you know this. A young Florida man with a history of convictions for petty theft found himself headed back to jail after he did what to a judge? Anyone specifically? He allegedly stole the nameplate off the judge's door and then had a picture of himself holding the nameplate posted to his girlfriend's Facebook page. So people like that bring down the IQ curves ahead. Listen, our thanks today to Deborah Saunders, Dr. Larry Gersten, and Brian Caulfield. Thank you to you, our audience here and online. MP3 audio files of today's program are available at CommonwealthClubStore.com. Be sure to join us Friday, March 30th for the next edition of Week to Week. And this program of the Commonwealth Club of California is complete. Have a great weekend.